content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the August 15th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we see a smiling Donald Trump in his traditional blue suit, red tie. His hair is wavy. He's got a big grin on his face. He's standing in front of a display chart. It's a graph titled Job Growth, running from July 2024 to July 2025. And in black, as these graphs go, it kind of goes up and down, and then it's starting to go up, and in the latest downturn, Mr. Trump has taken a red marker, scratched it out, and he's drawn a red line going straight up and off the chart. The headline is Uncharted Territory. Is Trump trying to hide an economic slowdown? We'll get that on the Controversy of the Week. We'll start with the second main story today. Texas gerrymander battle spreads to other states. What happened? A fight over redistricting in Texas went nationwide this week, with Texas Democrats fleeing their state to block a vote on a new electoral map and blue states vowing to forge ahead with their own partisan gerrymanders. While congressional districts are typically redrawn once a decade after the census, President Trump asked Texas Republicans to do so now, hoping to deliver additional GOP seats for the House in next year's midterms. "I get the highest vote in the history of Texas," Trump said, speaking of the 2024 election, "and we are entitled to five more seats." To prevent Republicans from mustering a quorum for the vote, more than 50 Democratic state legislators hightailed it out of state, heading for blue strongholds like Illinois and New York, beyond the reach of Texas arrest warrants. Republican Governor Greg Abbott threatened to charge the absent Democrats with accepting bribes if they use donor money to cover the $500 fines they're incurring each day. And he filed a lawsuit to remove State Representative Gene Wu, chair of the Texas House Democratic Caucus, from his seat for shirking his duties. "Denying the governor a quorum was not an abandonment of my office," Wu said. "It was a fulfillment of my oath." Several Democratic governors, including New York's Kathy Hochul, California's Gavin Newsom, and Illinois' J.B. Pritzker, have said that if Texas adopts the new map, they may retaliate by creating new districts favoring Democrats in their states. "This is a war, and that's why the gloves are off," said Hochul. "Nor will Republican plans to remake the congressional map stop with Texas. The Trump administration has begun pressuring other GOP-controlled states such as Missouri, Ohio, and Indiana to follow suit." What the editorial said: "This is a naked Republican power grab," said the Houston Chronicle. "Texas is a red state, but 40% of its voters chose Democrats for Congress last year. Under the new map, Democrats would safely hold only 21% of seats. Redrawing districts out of season like this isn't about fairness. It's just a way for Abbott to show fealty to Trump. And if the governor goes through with his threat to jail or expel the lawmakers who went AWOL, it would be an attack on democracy itself." Texas Republicans may be pushing political norms to their absolute limits, said National Review, but Democrats are the last people on earth who ought to be crying foul. Blue states are already far more gerrymandered than red ones. Look at Illinois, where Republicans won 47% of the 2024 congressional vote, but took just 18% of seats. Or Maryland, where Republicans got 35% of the vote and a single seat. Spare us the crocodile tears. What the columnist said: Democratic leaders across the nation have little choice but to fight back, said Daniel Strauss in Slate. It's palatable because they have traditionally led the charge to make redistricting fair and nonpartisan, and because polls show that both Democratic and Republican voters despise gerrymandering. But it's either abandon their principles to stop Trump's bludgeoning of American democracy, or keep their principles intact and congratulate themselves on a morally pristine loss in 2026. 2 more years of a Trump unchecked by Congress must be avoided at any cost. Yet even if they try, Democrats probably won't be able to offset the Republican pickups, said Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post. Republicans have full legislative control of 23 states to Democrats' 15, and past gerrymandering has left Democrats with fewer opportunities to squeeze out more seats in states they do control. Plus, for most Democratic states considering changes, there are too many practical obstacles and time constraints. California, for instance, requires a special election to allow for mid-decade redistricting, while New York would have to amend its constitution and make new maps before primary season starts. Congress can stop the madness at any point, said Richard L. Hassan in MSNBC.com. The Constitution allows the legislative branch to alter state rules for congressional elections. Congress could outlaw mid-decade redistricting, require states to use nonpartisan commissions, or at the very least, set a standard barring the most egregious partisan gerrymanders. Of course, since Republicans currently in charge of Congress are the ones making a mad dash for seats, don't hold your breath. But at some point, lawmakers should realize detente is better than mutually assured destruction. And the controversy of the week, economy. Can Trump rewrite the numbers? The firing of Erica McIntyre marks a new stage in the attempted authoritarian takeover of American democracy, said William Crystal in the Bulwark. Until last week, McIntyre was commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the nonpartisan body tasked with the dry work of gathering data on the number of Americans in employment. But after the BLS released figures showing anemic job growth in July and revised figures for May and June down by a combined 258,000 jobs, Trump fired McIntyre, accusing her in a social media post of having rigged the numbers to make the Republicans and me look bad. William Beach, McIntyre's Trump-appointed predecessor, called the firing totally groundless and a dangerous precedent that would undermine trust in government reports. More worrying is the precedent Trump is following, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. From the Soviet Union to modern-day Turkey and China, repressive regimes have long tried to stifle unwelcome information. Much will depend on who Trump picks to replace McIntyre. Someone much more competent and qualified, Trump insists. But as of now, government statisticians, scientists, and intelligence analysts know they need to tell the boss what he wants to hear or risk losing their jobs. There are genuine problems with BLS statistics, said Alicia Finley in the Wall Street Journal. The job numbers have become more volatile in recent years, with revised figures now routinely contradicting initial reports. But shooting the messenger won't fix the issue, which stems from the fact that fewer firms and households are answering the Bureau's surveys, with the business response rate dropping from 60% pre-pandemic to 43% today. A committee of unpaid economists was working to improve the BLS methodology, said Dominic Pino in National Review. This February, though, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick disbanded the group at the direction of the same president, ironically, who's now mad about inaccurate job reports. This is less a coup than a temper tantrum, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. Yes, Trump 2.0 arrived with detailed and devious plans to sabotage democracy, many cooked up by far-right think tanks and sinister aides like Stephen Miller and Russell Vaught, but he's also still ruled by the petty impulses of his lizard brain. When the jobs report came out, he likely thought, bureaucrats say Trump economy bad, Trump fire bureaucrat. Now economy good. It's the same impulse that led him to alter a hurricane forecast with a Sharpie in 2019. But Trump is deluding himself if he thinks he can trip the public into believing the economy is better than it is. As Joe Biden and Kamala Harris learned the hard way, voters don't judge the economy on the basis of jobs reports. They judge it on the basis of how they and their community are doing. And they could soon be doing much worse because of Trump, said Spencer Jacob in the Wall Street Journal. Confidence in the work product of America's bean counters underpins everything from the bond market to companies' hiring and investment decisions. Trump's overt interference erodes that confidence and could lead, paradoxically, to higher unemployment. And for what, said Philip Klein in National Review. If McIntyre's replacement issues a rosy jobs report, no one will believe it. While if the reported numbers are bad, analysts might suspect that even worse numbers are being hidden. Of all the reckless moves Trump has made this year, politicizing the BLS might be the one most likely to backfire. There's a good week, bad week piece. It's a good week for dirty laundry. After an unwashed, crystal-adorned sock once worn by Michael Jackson, the late pop star and alleged child abuser, sold at an auction in France for $8,822. It really is an exceptional object, said auctioneer Aurore Lilly. It was a good week for Romeo and Juliet. After an inter-family gun battle that broke out in Mama Sapano, Philippines, ended several hours later with both sides laying down their weapons and joyfully announcing the wedding of the two young family members whose surprise elopement had triggered the hostilities. It's a good week for blood sport after beachgoers were treated to the spectacle of a hammerhead shark fighting a stingray in the sparkling blue-green waters off the coast of Panama City, Florida. Although the encounter ended without a clear winner, one witness called the experience really amazing. But it was a bad week for Mr. Nibbies after Denmark's Aalborg Zoo appealed for donations of small, unwanted domestic pets to help feed its large predators. The zoo specifically mentioned guinea pigs, rabbits, and chickens, but added that it will consider any healthy animal that needs to be given away for various reasons. It's a bad week for morning brews after the makers of High Noon, a popular vodka seltzer, warned that some of its cans had been mislabeled as Celsius energy drinks, citrus-flavored pick-me-ups often consumed as a coffee substitute. The FDA issued a recall notice lest Celsius chugging go-getters experience unintentional alcohol ingestion. Finally, it was a bad week for kickoffs after Georgia Representative Mike Collins, announcing a run for the U.S. Senate, posted a campaign video online that ends with the rousing but misspelled slogan, Georgia, let's ride, spelled G-E-O-R-I-G-A. A Collins spokesperson claimed the video was the handiwork of unidentified fans who meant well. And in other news, RFK Jr. ends funding for mRNA vaccine development. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. this week continued his attack on the nation's vaccine development, cutting nearly $500 million in funding for new mRNA shots. He terminated 22 contracts for vaccine projects supported by the government's biodefense agency, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, first used to combat COVID, mRNA vaccines were considered a major scientific achievement because they can be quickly tweaked as viruses evolved. But Kennedy, a longtime anti-vaccine activist, has questioned their usage, despite studies proving their safety and efficacy. Kennedy claimed that shifting the funding would lead to safer vaccines. Jennifer Nuzzo, director of Brown University's Pandemic Center, called that wildly incorrect, saying that Kennedy is pushing toward a long-held goal of sowing doubts about all vaccines. The briefing this week is titled Unmaking Americans. Trump is threatening to revoke the citizenship of foreign-born Americans. Could he do that? What has Trump said? After months of targeting undocumented migrants and some legal immigrants for removal from the U.S., the president has recently turned his attention to American citizens. In July, Trump raised the possibility of deporting his South African-born ex-advisor Elon Musk and the Ugandan-born New York City Democratic mayoral candidate nominee Zohran Mamdani, explaining that we don't need a communist in this country, and said he was giving serious consideration to stripping comedian and Trump nemesis Rosie O'Donnell of her citizenship. The Supreme Court has ruled that U.S.-born citizens like O'Donnell cannot have their citizenship taken away, but the government can revoke the citizenship of naturalized foreign-born Americans who make up more than 7% of the population, about 25 million people, through a legal process known as denaturalization, which returns them to the immigration status they held before naturalizing. At that point, deportation proceedings can begin. And in June, the Justice Department said its civil division had been directed by Trump to maximally pursue denaturalization proceedings in all cases permitted by law and supported by the evidence. Is there a precedent for this policy? Denaturalization was remarkably common for much of the 20th century. The 1906 law that federalized the naturalization process included a provision allowing new Americans to lose their citizenship due to fraud, racial ineligibility, a clause that initially aimed at Chinese people, and lack of, quote, good moral character. Denaturalization quickly became a tool for ridding the American citizenry of undesirables, said historian Patrick Weil. That included the Russian-born anarchist Emma Goldman, whom the government had spent years unsuccessfully trying to deport. Those efforts initially fell flat because Goldman had legally obtained citizenship through her first marriage. But immigration officials investigated her ex-husband, found he'd put the wrong age on his citizenship application, and denaturalized him and Goldman using the 1906 law. She was deported in 1919, alongside 248 other considered foreign anarchist or communist. The 1940 Nationality Act expanded those eligible to be stripped of citizenship, including U.S.-born citizens who had joined a foreign army, voted in foreign elections, or deserted during wartime. How many people lost citizenship? Between 1907 and 1967, the government recorded about 22,000 denaturalizations. Weil estimates another 121,000 U.S.-born citizens lost their nationality from 1945 to 1977. The Supreme Court pared back the government's citizenship-stripping powers with a string of rulings in the 1950s and 60s the most significant being 1967's Afroyim versus Rusk. In 1960, the State Department declared that Polish-born painter Bas Afroyim had forfeited his U.S. citizenship by voting in a 1951 Israeli election. The Supreme Court overturned that decision and much of the 1940 Nationality Act in 1967, ruling that the 14th Amendment's Citizenship Clause says simply that all American-born or naturalized Americans are U.S. citizens, a status that only the individual can renounce. The government is without power to rob a citizen of his citizenship, wrote Justice Hugo Black. Denaturalization numbers dropped after that ruling, with only a few cases filed each year. What's the current legal situation? There are two grounds for denaturalization: committing serious human rights violations before naturalization, and committing fraud during the naturalization process. Officials must also demonstrate a person lacks good moral character. The most common targets in recent decades were naturalized citizens with undisclosed Nazi past, such as Fyodor Fedorenko, who kept secret that he'd been a guard at the Treblinka extermination camp. He was denaturalized in 1981 and deported to his native USSR, where he was executed in 1987. Denaturalization investigations began to ramp up with the 2010 launch of Operation Janus under President Obama, which used new digital tools to search for discrepancies in fingerprint data that might indicate naturalization fraud. Some 315,000 potential cases were flagged, but because such investigations require significant resources, the first Janus denaturalization occurred in 2018 under President Trump. Around the same time, Trump created a denaturalization task force to examine the files of some 700,000 naturalized citizens. In total, 102 denaturalization cases were filed during the first Trump administration. The Biden administration filed 24. Who's being targeted now? The DOJ's June memo lists 10 potential grounds for denaturalization, including having links to terrorism, gangs, or cartels, committing fraud against the government or individuals, and any other cases deemed sufficiently important to pursue. Immigration experts and former officials warn that the memo is so broad that it could be used to denaturalize Americans for minor infractions, such as underpayment of taxes. Representative Andy Ogles, Republican from Tennessee, has argued that Mamdani should be denaturalized for writing rap lyrics that he said suggest support for Hamas. Immigration lawyers say such an argument is unlikely to succeed in court because in civil denaturalization cases, the government has to show clear, convincing, and unequivocal evidence which does not leave the issue in doubt. Playing a game of gotcha with naturalization applicants isn't going to work, said Jeremy McKinney, former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. But he notes that simply threatening denaturalization can create a climate of panic and anxiety and fear in which naturalized critics of the Trump administration may think twice before speaking up. They're doing that very well, said McKinney. So, mission accomplished in that regard. Moving into best columns, first two come from the U.S. The Russia hoax was all too real. On the ropes over the Jeffrey Epstein affair, President Trump is yet again harping on the Russia hoax, said David French. Attorney General Pam Bondi this week directed prosecutors to launch a grand jury investigation into allegations that Obama administration officials had manufactured intelligence to make it look like Russia intervened on President Trump's behalf in the 2016 election. Those allegations are utterly ridiculous and distract from a crucial fact, that Russia did attempt to swing the election to Trump through inflammatory social media posts and a hack and leak campaign against top Democrats. So concluded a bipartisan 2020 Senate Intelligence Committee report, co-authored by Marco Rubio, now Trump's Secretary of State, that exposed many disturbing contacts between members of the Trump campaign and Russians or Russian assets. But Republicans so wholeheartedly bought Trump's claim that he was a victim of a maliciously corrupt deep state that this deflect and deny approach became his go-to strategy for every scandal. Now struggling to answer questions from his own supporters about his long friendship with Epstein, it's no surprise that Trump has retreated to his Russia hoax safe space. But as multiple investigations have shown, the only Russia hoax is the idea that there was nothing to investigate. Why Trump's agenda will outlast him. For good and often ill, the Trump revolution is probably here to stay, said Megan McArdle. Even if a majority of Americans turns against the president's tariff, immigration, and anti-DEI policies in our political system, it is at least as hard to unmake major changes as it is to make them. We saw that with Obamacare, which Republicans forcefully vowed to repeal but haven't, since that would have meant removing parts of the law that voters liked. We'll likely see the same with Trump's innovations. Tariffs are bad policy, but no future administration is likely to repeal those import taxes and lose the revenue they generate. Cruel raids by masked ICE agents have been met with horror, but that doesn't mean the public will want to return to Biden-era mass migration. And there will be no politically easy way to bring foreign workers back. And the DEI bureaucracy will be nearly impossible to revive, because the courts have now clarified where racial preferences are legally forbidden. And even if Democrats wanted to rewrite discrimination laws, it would require them to publicly confront unpopular trade-offs. In our atrophied political system, if you manage the feat of getting a program passed, it's likely to outlive you. This column comes from India, a state that throws nuns into prison. Hindu nationalists are using hysteria over religious conversions to harass Christians, said the Hindu. Just last month, two Catholic nuns were arrested at a railway station in Chhattisgarh state and charged with human trafficking and forced conversion. Their crime? Escorting three tribal girls who were coming to the convent for work. A Hindu nationalist militant group filed a complaint, and the state accused the nuns of luring the young women into Catholicism. The girls' family said the charges were ridiculous and that their children hadn't been pressured. And now lawmakers across the political spectrum have condemned the state's overreach. But this isn't the first time a proselytization row has erupted under Prime Minister Narendra Modi, whose Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party has governed India since 2014. Other BJP-run states have also arrested people on spurious charges of turning Hindus from their faith. Some have even tried to criminalize interfaith marriages by labeling conversion by marriage as unlawful. The irony is that tribal leaders allege that Hindu groups are doing exactly what they accuse Christian missionaries of doing, proselytizing among the tribes in an attempt to subsume their distinct culture. This is a perversion of state authority. The government's job is to enforce rights guaranteed by the Constitution, not violate them. last word, our in-depth article. All the king's censors, the bureaucrats who oversaw British theater for more than 200 years, claimed to be battling vulgarity, said Thomas Chatterton Williams in The Atlantic. In reality, they squelched artistry and originality. Several stories below the British Library's Magna Carta Room, alongside a rumbling line of the London Underground, is a brightly lit labyrinth of rare and historic items. Past a series of antique rifles chained to a wall, past an intricate system of conveyor belts whisking books to the surface, the library stores an enormous collection of plays, manuscripts, and letters. Last spring, I checked my belongings at security and descended to sift through this archive, a record of correspondence between the producers and directors of British theater and a small team of censors who once worked for the Crown. For centuries, these strict, dyspeptic, and sometimes unintentionally hilarious bureaucrats read and passed judgment on every public theatrical production in Britain, striking out references to sex, God, and politics, and forcing playwrights to, as one put it, cook their conceptions to the taste of authority. They reported that to the Lord Chamberlain's office, which in 1737 became responsible for granting licenses to theaters and approving the text of plays, examiners made sure that no productions would offend the sovereign, blaspheme the church, or stir audiences to political radicalism. An 1843 act expanded the department's powers, calling upon it to block any play threaten not just the public peace, but decorum and good manners. Hardly chosen for their artistic sensibilities or knowledge of theatrical history, the men hired by the Lord Chamberlain's office were mostly retired military officers from the upper middle class. From the Victorian era on, they scrutinized plays for references to racial equality and sexuality, particularly homosexuality, vulgar language, and offensive personalities, as one guideline put it. 20th century English theater was, as a result of all this vigilance, subject to more censorship than in the reigns of Elizabeth I, James I, and Charles I, wrote the playwright and former theater critic Nicolas de Jong in his 2000 survey of censorship, Politics, Prudery, and Perversions. The censors suppressed or bowdlerized countless works of genius. As I thumbed through every play I could think of from the 1820s to the 1960s, earlier manuscripts sold as part of the examiner's private archive can be seen in the Huntington Library in California, it became clear that the censors only got stricter and more prudish over time. "Do not come to me with Ibsen," warned the examiner E.F. Smith Pigott, nicely demonstrating the censor's habitual tone. He had studied Ibsen's plays pretty carefully and determined that the characters were, to a man, morally deranged. In cardboard boxes stacked on endless rows of metal shelving, string tie binders hold the original versions of thousands of plays. The text of each is accompanied by a typewritten reader's report, most of them several pages long, summarizing the plot and cataloging the work's flaws as well as any redeeming qualities. That is followed, when available, by typed and handwritten correspondence between the censors and the applicants, usually the play's hopeful and ingratiating producers. These reports can at times be entertaining as the plays themselves. On Beckett's Waiting for Godot, one examiner wrote, "Omit the business and speeches about fly buttons." On Sartre's Huy Clos, the play illustrates very well the difference between the French and English taste. "I don't support that anyone would bat an eyelid over it in Paris, but here we bar lesbians on the stage." On Camus' Caligula, "This is a sort of play for which I have no liking at all." On Tennessee Williams, Neuroses grin through everything he writes. And on Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun, a good play about Negroes in a Chicago slum, written with dignity, power, and complete freedom from whimsy. The title is taken from a worthless piece of occasional verse about dreams deferred drying up like raisins in the sun, or festering and exploding. These bureaucrats were eager, as one of them wrote, to lop off a few excrescent boughs to save the tree. They were anti-Semitic. One successful compromise involved placing the script's use of F the Pope with the Pope's a Jew, and virulently homophobic. In response to Williams suddenly last summer in 1958, one Lieutenant Colonel Vincent Troubridge noted, "There was a great fuss in New York about the references to cannibalism at the end of this play, but the Lord Chamberlain will find more objectionable the indications that the dead man was a homosexual." But the censors could also occasionally aspire to the level of pointed and biting literary criticism. "This is a piece of incoherence in the manner of Samuel Beckett," the report for a 1960 production of Harold Printer's The Caretaker begins. "Though it has not that author's vein of nihilistic pessimism, and each individual sentence is comprehensible, if irrelevant." One gets the impression that, like the characters from the Bolaño novel, at least some of these men were themselves failed artists and intellectuals, drawn to such authoritarian work from a place of bruised and envious ego. Indeed, one examiner, Jeffrey Dermer, considered among the more flexible, had written poetry during the Great War. He reported to the Lord Chamberlain alongside the tyrannical Charles Heriot, who had studied theater at university and worked on a production of Macbeth before moving, still as a young man, into advertising, journalism, and book publishing. He was known, De Jong wrote, for being gratuitously abusive. Here Heriot on Edward Bond's 1965 Saved, a revolting amateur play about a bunch of brainless ape-like yobs, including a brainless slut of 23 living with her sluttish parents. The director, Peter Hall, writing in The Guardian in 2002 about his experiences with the censors, said that the office was largely staffed by retired naval officers with extraordinarily filthy minds. They were so alert to filth that they often found it when none was intended. Once he called to ask why some lines had been cut from a play he was directing. "We all know what's going on here, Hall, don't we?" said the retired naval officer angrily. "It's up periscopes." "Up periscopes?" I queried. "Buggery, Hall, buggery." Actually, it wasn't. As comic as these men seem now, they wielded enormous, unexamined power. The correspondence filed along the side the manuscripts reveals the extent to which the pressures of censorship warped manuscripts long before they even arrived on the censors' desks. Managers and production companies checked scripts and suggested changes in anticipation of scrutiny. In a 1967 letter, representative of a dramatic society eager to stage Waiting for Godot writes, "On page 81, Estragon says, 'Who farted?' The director and myself are concerned as to whether, during a public presentation, this might offend the laws of censorship. Awaiting your advice." Presumably, the answer was affirmative. Some plays made it past censors only as a result of human error. When I met Kate Dossett, a professor at the University of Leeds who specializes in black theater history, she told me that the case of playwright Una Marson is an example of what gets hidden in this collection. Marson's 1932 play, At What a Price, depicts a young black woman from the Jamaican countryside who moves to Kingston and takes a job as a stenographer. Her white employer seduces, or in today's understanding, sexually harasses and impregnates her. The drama is a subtle exploration of miscegenation, one of the core taboos that the LCO often clamped down on. But the play was approved because the examiner, confused by the protagonist's class markers and education, didn't realize that she was black. Some prominent figures fought against the system of censorship. Henry James, in his day, spoke out in defense of the English playwright, who has less dignity, thanks to the censor's arbitrary rights upon his work, than that of any other man of letters in Europe. So too did George Bernard Shaw. It is a frightful thing to see the greatest thinkers, poets, and authors of modern Europe, men like Ibsen, Shaw wrote, delivered helplessly into the vulgar hands of such a noodle as this despised and incapable old official. But at the time of the Theatres Act of 1968, abolished the censorship of plays, social attitudes were changing. The influx of workers from Jamaica and other countries in the Commonwealth in the 1950s challenged the stability of racial dynamics. Sex between men was decriminalized in England and Wales in 1967. Divorce became more common, and the rock and roll era destigmatized drugs. It must have gotten lonely, trying to stand so long against the changing times. "I don't understand this," Harriet wrote plaintively about hair. The American musical was banned 3 times for extolling dirt, anti-establishment views, homosexuality, and free love. But in the end, one gets the impression that the censors just gave up. Alexander Locke, a curator at the library, pointed me to Harriet's report on the final version of the musical. The pain of defeat in his voice is almost palpable. A curiously half-hearted attempt to vet the script had been made, he wrote, but many offenses were left intact. Hair opened in the Shaftesbury Theater in September 1968. That month, by royal assent, no new plays required approval from the Lord Chamberlain's office, which was left to devote its attention to the planning of royal weddings, funerals, and garden parties. Some may be tempted to dismiss the censor's legacy as limited to, as a 1967 article in the Times of London had it, the trivia of indecency, but the damage was far deeper. The censors, De Jong wrote, stunted English theater, kept it frivolous and parochial. No playwrights addressed the fascist regimes of the 1930s, the process that led to the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ghastliness perpetrated by Hitler and Stalin, or the tyrannies experienced in China and under other totalitarian leaderships. No wonder their plays would have been disallowed. In the 1930s, you could not win licenses for plays that might offend Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin. These practices may strike us today as outlandish and anachronistic. Many of us take for granted creative license and the freedom of expression that undergirds it. But the foundation upon which these rights, as we think of them, are situated is far less immutable than we would like to imagine. As recent trends in the United States and elsewhere have shown, advances toward greater tolerance are reversible. Indeed, many Americans on both the right and left correctly sense this, even if they do not always understand what genuine censorship looks like. Activists on college campuses have confused the ability to occupy and disrupt physical space for the right to dissent verbally. Meanwhile, Elon Musk warns that wokeness will stifle free speech, even as he uses the social media site he owns to manipulate public debate. Perusing the plays in the Lord Chamberlain's archive, among other things, a reminder of what censorship really is. Government power applied to speech to either limit or compel it. And it is also a reminder that in the long term, many such attempts backfire. They reveal, as Sir Raleigh Keating, who was chief executive of the library from 2012 until the beginning of this year, told me, more about the censors' own fears, paranoias, obsessions than they ever succeed in concealing. There is also the sheer fact of what Keating called this extraordinary imposition of bureaucracy. Just as the Stasi archive provides unparalleled insight into the interplay of art and politics in post-war East German society, and the Hoover-era FBI's copious files on Martin Luther King Jr., James Baldwin, and other black Americans, American luminaries, amount to a valuable cultural repository, the Lord Chamberlain's archive can now be seen as one of the preeminent collections of black and queer theater in the English-speaking world. It includes not just the plays that were staged, but also those that were rejected, and in some cases, multiple drafts of them. Theater's an ephemeral medium, Keating told me. Early drafts of plays change all the time. Many don't get published at all. Among the many ramifications of censorship, I had not adequately considered this one. The degree to which methodical suppression can create the most meticulous collection. It is a deeply satisfying justice, even a form of revenge, that the hapless bureaucrats who endeavor to so relentlessly to squelch and block independent thought have instead so painstakingly preserved it for future generations. A version of this story was originally published in The Atlantic. Looks like we've got time for a couple of the Talking Points articles. We'll start with EPA, a bonfire of climate change regulations. The Trump administration is trying to unmake virtually all climate change regulations in one fell swoop, said Darna Noor and Oliver Millman in The Guardian. The Environmental Protection Agency last week unveiled a proposal to rescind its 2009 endangerment finding, the scientific conclusion that carbon dioxide poses a threat to human health. Without that finding, the EPA would lose its ability to limit planet heating pollution from vehicles, power plants, and oil wells, despite the overwhelming scientific consensus that a swift reduction in these emissions is needed to avert catastrophic global warming. The Trump administration's argument for rescinding is a medley of strained legal and scientific arguments, said Jody Freeman in the Los Angeles Times. It attacks the scientific basis for the finding, calling it unreliable based on a report by five hand-picked scientists known for their outlier views, and then claims that regulating greenhouse gases simply costs too much and accomplishes too little. A lengthy court fight is ahead, but even if this fossil fuel-loving administration loses, it will win by paralyzing climate action for years. The EPA is simply looking to undo what Congress never gave the agency the authority to do, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The Clean Air Act authorizes the agency only to control pollutants that directly harm human health, like ozone, particulate matter, and sulfur dioxide. But higher atmospheric levels of greenhouse gases won't make you sick, and their climate effects depend on sundry variables like cloud cover, which the EPA can't regulate. Democrats will likely sue to block the proposal when it becomes final, and that would make the administration's day. Current Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the dissent in the 2007 case that paved the way for the endangerment finding, calling material loss from carbon emissions pure conjecture, and the rest of the court's conservative majority likely shares that opinion. If we can't appeal to the law to halt this dangerous proposal, maybe we can appeal to math, said Mark Gongloff in Bloomberg. EPA head Lee Zeldin has called scrapping the endangerment finding an economic issue, promising it would result in over $1 trillion in savings by freeing companies from regulation. But the economic damage from U.S. carbon emissions alone could hit a blistering $87 trillion through 2050, according to one study, as a warmer atmosphere supercharges hurricanes, floods, droughts, and wildfires. And the more Zeldin and Trump undo climate progress, the higher that cost will rise. That $1 trillion gets less significant by the hour. Israel losing the American public. The transformation of Israel's image from David to Goliath, from righteous to wrathful, has tarnished its reputation in the U.S., said Jackie Calmes in the Los Angeles Times. A Gallup poll published last week found that only 32% of Americans back Israel's military action in Gaza, down from 50% in late 2023. The survey was conducted last month, largely before the torrent of heart-rending photos of malnourished babies spread around the world. The reduced support was driven by increased opposition among Democrats and independents, only 8% and 25% of whom respectively back Israel's war aims. Some on the American right are also lashing out, said Jacob Magid in the Times of Israel. According to a Pew Research poll from April, 50% of young Republicans view Israel unfavorably, up from 35% in 2022. That animosity is shared by a few sitting GOP lawmakers. MAGA firebrand Marjorie Taylor Greene, for instance, is no less critical of the Jewish state than some of the most progressive Democrats. As President Trump reportedly put it while speaking to a prominent Jewish donor, "My people are starting to hate Israel." The idea that the GOP is divided over Israel is, however, mostly fiction, said Matthew Continetti in the Free Press. Yes, the predictable foreign policy restrainers like Tucker Carlson are blasting Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu through their megaphones, but Trump remains as resolutely pro-Israel as ever, and the vast majority of Republican voters continue to reward politicians who stand with the Jewish state against jihadism. That Gallup poll, Republican support for Israel's war against Hamas actually jumped from 66% to 71%. The data simply don't back the notion that the reliably pro-Israel GOP is wobbly. While Trump and his supporters have stuck with the Netanyahu, Israel can't ignore that the world and a majority of Americans have turned against it, said Joe Klein in his Substack newsletter. Israel becoming a pariah state would be all too convenient for the anti-Semites, and Jews everywhere, including the U.S., would suffer. So American Jews who carry some weight in Israel should strive for unanimity on both the evil of Hamas and the excesses of the Netanyahu government. In the U.S., every Jewish pulpit in the land should call for an end to starvation and displacement in Gaza. A strong Israel serves as a security blanket for the Jewish people in a hostile world, and its future is essential. But decency is integral to real moral strength. And a few of the short notes. The federal government is paying more than 154,000 government employees not to work as part of a buyout offer intended to shrink the federal workforce. The workers from dozens of agencies took deferred resignations and will be paid full salary and benefits until the end of fiscal year on September 30th, or in some cases, through the end of the calendar year. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has launched a recruiting drive calling for heroic Americans to defend the homeland by serving as deportation officers, investigators, and lawyers. ICE, which is seeking to hire 10,000 new agents, is offering signing bonuses of up to $50,000 and benefits including student loan forgiveness. Russia last month lost 6,443 drones and missiles into Ukraine, the highest number since the war started in February 2022, and 13% more than it fired in June, according to the Ukrainian Air Force. Despite a messy breakup with President Trump and promises to start a third party, Elon Musk on June 27 donated $10 million to the main super PACs backing House and Senate Republicans, making the billionaire the largest individual donor to both groups in the first half of 2025. The former Doge chief and Tesla boss also sent $5 million to MAGA Inc., Trump's super PAC. On the poll watch, 59% of Americans believe that only illegal immigrants charged with crimes should be deported, including 40% of Republicans. 49% say that ICE has been too aggressive in its deportation efforts. 59% oppose spending more on immigration detention centers, while 55% are against spending on the border wall. And we'll close out the show today with a quote from Bill McGowan, quoted in the Wall Street Journal, who says, "Somewhere rummaging around in the backs of our brains is this fallacy that the longer I talk, the more convincing I'm going to be." Well, maybe I'll just start talking then. With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.